content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we will complete the article titled The Feminist Behind the Man Behind the Curtain by Evan I. Schwartz, The Untold Story of Matilda Gage, the freethinker who inspired her son-in-law, L. Frank Baum's classic novel, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. The spring of 1891, the Baum family moved to Chicago, where Frank got a job working for the city's Evening Post. In this new chapter of his life, he accompanied his mother-in-law to lectures, seances, and other gatherings. In September 1892, he became a member of a group called the Theosophical Society. Founded in New York City, the society was led by the Russian mystic, Madame Helena Blavatsky. Matilda, a freethinker like her father, had joined the society at a conference in Rochester, New York, in March 1885. The brew of theosophical beliefs appealed to Gage. The ancient wisdom of Hinduism and Buddhism, combined with other mystical ideas like mediumship and telepathy, and all of it with an emphasis on universal human rights and living a life of nonviolence in both word and deed. A mission statement published by the group's founders in 1882 defined theosophy as, quote, a universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, or color. Gage thought theosophy the crown blessing of her life. Baum was especially interested in theosophy's description of the astral plane, a world of emotion and illusion where one's astral body could go for a supernatural experience reached through mental powers. An 1895 book called The Astral Plane, Its Scenery, Inhabitants, and Phenomena would become so popular in the family that three copies would circulate among the Baum and Gage households. In 1893, Gage published Woman, Church, and State, her most influential work. Gage called it a, quote, a book with a revolution in it, end quote. The 450-page volume put forth the provocative view that church and state had been suppressing women for centuries. The book was banned by her nemesis, Anthony Comstock, a U.S. postal inspector and the secretary of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, who called it, quote, salacious, end quote, and declared he would bring criminal proceedings against any person who placed it in a public school or sent it through the U.S. mail. Gage cited passages from the King James Bible, such as, quote, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, end quote, Exodus 22:18, showing the link between the preaching of religion and accusations of witchcraft. She traced this misogyny back to the Garden of Eden with the tale of Eve, the trickster serpent and the forbidden fruit. Quote, a system of religion was adopted which taught the greater sinfulness of women, she asserted, and the persecution for witchcraft became chiefly directed against women, end quote. As this view gained traction within the church, Gage wrote, quote, a witch was held to be a woman who had deliberately sold herself to the evil one, end quote. Anything could be used as evidence of witchcraft, possessing rare knowledge, having an unusual witch mark, suffering from mental illness, owning black cats, the use of herbs for healing, performing black magic, or having an ability to float or swim. But, quote, those condemned as sorcerers and witches, as heretics, were in reality the most advanced thinkers of the Christian ages, end quote, Gage wrote. She was especially moved by an 1883 gathering in Salem, Massachusetts, for descendants of Rebecca Nurse, one of the best-known women put to death in the Salem witch trials of 1692. Nurse was a 70-year-old woman with 8 children, and as Gage wrote, quote, a church member of unsullied reputation and devout habit. But all these considerations did not prevent her accusation, and she was hung by the neck till she was dead, end quote. Gage was promoting her new book when she visited the 1893 Columbian Exposition, a spectacular World's Fair in Chicago. Her son-in-law was covering the sprawling event as a reporter, and he wrote about the light pouring through the walls of windows of the white buildings, so bright that people purchased colored eye shades from vendors. The detail would later reappear in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, where all the residents of Emerald City wear green eye shades. Because if you do not wear spectacles, the brightness and glory of the Emerald City would blind you, Baum would write in the novel. Indeed, the Oz novel's illustrations would be sketched by William Wallace Denslow, who was drawing splendorous images of the fair's fanciful architecture for another Chicago paper. One day, Gage visited the exposition's Woman's Building and encountered statues immortalizing her old colleagues Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Seeing the statues only increased her ire at her old colleagues for aligning with the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She also felt undervalued as a writer, and she harbored suspicions that Anthony had taken funds from a joint account to pay her own exorbitant travel expenses. "They have stabbed me in reputation, and Susan, at least, has stolen money from me," she wrote in a July 1893 letter to her son Thomas. "They are traitors, also, to the woman's highest needs." Gage herself was falling into poverty. The cost of publishing and promoting her new book had exceeded its earnings, and she was now in debt. "I like an active life and one with freedom from money troubles," Gage wrote. "I like to be independent in every way. But fate or karma is against me." In February of 1895, Gage came across a writing contest in the children's magazine, The Youth's Companion, offering a prize for $500 for the best original story. The rich sum, equivalent to more than $18,000 today, seized her attention, and she considered her daughter Helen and her son-in-law Frank the family's best writers. While there are no known records of her in-person conversations with Frank, she likely shared the same ideas she sent Helen in a letter. "Keep in mind it is not a child's paper, but a paper for youth and the older members of the family," she wrote. "The moral tone and literary character of these stories must be exceptional." She encouraged them to write not narration or passages from history, but stories, which she defined as tales with a dramatic arc from the beginning to the end. Gage went so far to suggest a topic. "If you could get up a series of adventures or a Dakota Blizzard adventure where a heroic teacher saves children's lives," or, she added, "bring in a cyclone," perhaps recalling a true twister story of a house rising off its foundation that Helen had written in the Syracuse Weekly Express in 1887. Above all, Gage added, "create fiction which comes with a moral, however, without any attempt to sermonize." There's no evidence that Baum entered the particular contest, but around that time he began a new routine. He moved on to a new day job as a traveling salesman of fine china for Pitkin and Brooks. Every evening, especially when he was away at hotels, he'd write down ideas in a journal. Soon Baum became submitting his tales and poems to newspapers and magazines. At first, Baum kept track of his rejection letters in a journal called his Record of Failure, a title that could have described his whole business career, too. But in early 1896, Baum started receiving acceptance letters for his short stories. In January 1896, the Chicago Times-Herald published a story of his titled Who Called Perry in February. The same paper published his story Yesterday at the Exposition, which imagined a World's Fair in Chicago nearly 200 years in the future. His first national magazine story was called The Extravagance of Dan and published in the National Magazine in May 1897. Once his submissions started getting accepted, the stories kept coming, typically turning real life into the poetic. With both earnings and confidence rising, Baum expanded his vision to two successful books for children, Mother Goose in Prose, 1897, a collection of short stories based on traditional nursery rhymes, and Father Goose, his book, 1899, a series of original nonsense poems. In October 1899, he got a story called Aunt Hulda's Good Time into the magazine, first suggested by his mother-in-law, the prestigious Youth's Companion. For the first time, the Baums were able to afford a stately home, a Victorian on Humboldt Boulevard wired with electric lights and featuring a covered front porch where Baum would tell stories to his sons and the neighborhood children. He maintained a close relationship with his mother-in-law. "Frank came in and kissed me goodbye, as he always does," wrote Gage. "He is very kind to me." Gage was staying with the Baums in Chicago while she was confined to bed with pain in her lungs, throat, and stomach. "We all must die, and I pray to go quickly when I leave," she wrote in an 1897 letter. "I would 1,000 times prefer black death to long-term paralysis. The real suffering comes from a lack of knowledge of real things, the spiritual." In Washington, D.C., thousands of activists were gathering for a convention to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the Seneca Falls Conference. Unable to attend, Gage penned a final speech that would be read aloud by the convention by a friend. Gage proclaimed what she called, quote, "the femininity of the divine," end quote, and shared her belief that one day, quote, "the feminine will soon be fully restored to its rightful place in creation," end quote. Gage also wrote messages to her loved ones and colleagues as part of her last will and testament. "I am one of those that are set for the redeeming of the earth," Gage wrote to Baum. "I am to live on the plane that shall be above things that dishearten. When I receive instructions from those who are in the invisible, I will receive them willingly, with a desire to put them into practice to the extent of my spirit light and potency." Matilda Electa Joslyn Gage died on March 18, 1898. Her four-paragraph obituary in the New York Times reported her death was caused by apoplexy, an old medical term for a stroke, but also meaning a state of extreme rage. Following a small ceremony for her mother in Chicago, Maud left her husband behind with their four sons and transported the urn of her mother's remains east, to be interred by the old house in Fayetteville alongside her father's grave. This is when the magic happened. The story moved right in and took possession, Baum later said. The inspiration came at the twilight of a winter's day when he saw his sons and their friends returning home from playing in the snow. "It came to me right out of the blue," he said. "I shooed the children away." Word paintings came out through his pencil into scraps of paper. A gray prairie, a terrifying twister, a mystical land ruled by both good and wicked witches, a trio of comical characters who join a girl on her quest, a journey to a magical city of emeralds controlled by a mysterious wizard. The story really seemed to write itself, he told his publisher. Yet at first, Baum hadn't settled on the name for his main character. In June 1898, Maud's brother and wife welcomed a girl they named Dorothy. Maud enjoyed visiting them in Bloomington, Illinois that summer, but the baby became ill and started running fevers. On November 11th, only 5 months old, Dorothy Louise Gage died. "She was a perfectly beautiful baby," Maud mourned. "I could have taken her for my very own and loved her devotedly." In Baum's writings, the girl from Kansas took on the name Dorothy, with a last name Gale. That was perhaps a double reference to the Gale Force cyclone and the family name of Gage. His mother-in-law also lived on through story. She believed strongly in mental manifestation, insisting that people could accomplish anything through the power of their minds. When Helen's daughter Leslie fell ill in 1895, Gage had prescribed positive thought energy. "Take 5 minutes, 3 or 4 times a day, to think of health, and when you go to bed at night, keep saying to yourself, 'I am well.' Grandma knows by experience that a great deal of good comes from concentration of thought." As a woman who spent her whole life urging women to have confidence in themselves, Gage would have been pleased to see that her views taking on a central role in the story of Oz. Dorothy's silver shoes in the movie Ruby Slippers are not magical in themselves. It's only after a lesson from Glinda on the power of thought that their magic can work. As the good witch Glinda tells Dorothy, "All you have to do is knock the heels together 3 times and command the shoes to carry you wherever you wish to go." Next, we'll move on to an article titled When Ornithology Grew Up by Tim Gallagher. Arthur Allen changed science forever with one simple idea, Stop Killing Rare Birds. Arthur Allen carefully packed his camera and luggage at his home in Ithaca, New York. He would soon head south to the backwoods swamps of Osceola County, Florida, to search for a ghost bird, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Most scientists considered it extinct. Allen was desperate to prove them wrong. The year was 1924, and Allen was an energetic ornithology professor at Cornell University, about to take a sabbatical. A stocky, outgoing man with a bushy mustache, he'd always been popular with his students, who called him Doc Allen, and liked how he never talked down to them. He'd been born and raised in working-class Buffalo, New York, moving to Ithaca in 1904 to study at Cornell, and never left. Allen was not the first to be enthralled by this charismatic bird, the largest woodpecker in the U.S., with stunning black and white plumage, gleaming white bill, and yellow eyes. In the 18th century, the English artist and naturalist Mark Catesby described the bird and painted it for the first volume of his Natural History of Carolina, Florida, and the Bahama Islands, published in 1731. The bird later caught the attention of several early 19th century naturalists, including artists Alexander Wilson and John James Audubon, who included paintings of the species in their books. For artistic accuracy, they collected a few specimens, which was not a problem at that point. But that soon changed as people cut down vast tracts of forest to make way for farmland, destroying vital habitats. They also killed many birds for commercial gain, driving some species to extinction, most notably the passenger pigeon, which was shot by millions as food for people and livestock. Allen was obsessive about studying birds, especially species that were vanishing. At this point, the great auk, passenger pigeon, and Carolina parakeet were already extinct, and most thought the ivory-billed woodpecker was also gone. Allen was determined to spend months, if necessary, scouring Florida in search of this bird, to study the species in depth and take photographs. The trip would herald a new era in ornithology, one where scientists stopped killing rare birds and started trying to keep them alive. Before 1796, when French scientist Georges Cuvier first proposed the concept of extinction, people didn't know a species could be lost forever. The idea that any of God's creatures could just vanish from Earth was simply unthinkable. In the previous decade, Thomas Jefferson had written, "Such is the economy of nature that no instance can be produced of her having permitted any one race of her animals to become extinct." And yet, in the Victorian era, when people did become aware that species could be lost, it only heightened their interest in shooting them to add to collections. The Victorian age was the heyday of specimen collecting, especially birds and their eggs, and the species closest to extinction were the ones most prized. "Now is the time to collect," wrote W.T. Hornaday, then the Smithsonian's chief taxidermist, in an 1891 book. "The time will come when the majority of the vertebrate species now inhabiting the earth will either be totally exterminated or exist only under protection." Prominent figures in ornithology were involved in the slaughter. William Brewster, co-founder and early president of the American Ornithologists Union, AOU, now the American Ornithological Society, owned more than 40,000 specimens and later became curator of Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. He shot many birds himself and bought rare bird carcasses from other enthusiasts, including his friend Arthur T. Wayne. After one trip in 1892, Wayne wrote Brewster that he had collected 43 Bachman's warblers, a bird now extinct, and 13 fine ivory-billed woodpeckers. Wayne later placed an advertisement on the back of the cover of AOU's journal, The Auk, offering 4 pairs of ivory bills for sale. It appeared below an ad for repeating rifles. Scientists certainly knew what was happening with the ivory bill. "The probabilities that the ivory-billed woodpecker would soon be extinct," wrote naturalist Charles Abbott in 1894. "It is too handsome not to tempt every collector, taxidermist, and millinery establishment in the country, and he who protests will be laughed at for his trouble." Besides the birds being killed by collectors, millions of herons, egrets, and other birds were being slaughtered for the fashion industry to provide adornments for women's hats and other garments. Yet some began to blanch at this cruel ostentation. A group of wealthy society women in Boston began arranging boycotts of feather garments and eventually formed the Massachusetts Audubon Society, dedicated to bird conservation. Soon more Audubon societies were formed in other cities and states, but these conservationists were not always taken seriously by professional ornithologists, who often viewed them as parochial animal lovers and laughed at their efforts. When AOU President Charles B. Corey was invited to attend an Audubon Society meeting in 1902, he replied, "I do not protect birds, I kill them." Arthur Allen was different. He cared deeply about living birds and dedicated himself to studying them. No one had ever done an in-depth study of the ivory-billed woodpecker, and though he knew the bird might already be extinct, he felt he had to try. Florida had been a stronghold for ivory bills in the past decades, and was where most museum specimens of the bird, which already numbered in the hundreds, had come from. So that's where he set his sights. Perhaps he could find some forgotten nook of the state where a few of them still managed to hang on. The problem was where to look. Florida is huge, and he had a limited amount of time. Allen advertised that he was willing to pay for information that could point him to a living ivory bill. He heard from several people and spent nearly a month checking their claims, but the birds all turned out to be common pileated woodpeckers. Then a rancher named Morgan Tyndale got in touch, claiming he'd seen an ivoryville less than 30 miles from where Arthur Allen and his wife, fellow ornithologist Elsa, were staying. Tyndale's description of the bird was spot on, so they arranged to spend a few days camping with him near where he'd seen it. Tyndale was sitting in a battered Ford Model T when the Allens arrived at their meeting place. He was a tall, wiry man in his 60s, with a droopy gray walrus mustache and a flat-brimmed Stetson. The Allens quizzed him about the sighting and listened closely as he talked about the ivory bills he'd seen over the years while working cattle. It was a wild ride as they tore across the trackless pine barrens with Tyndale in the lead. He finally stopped near the cypress swamp where he'd seen an ivory bill, and they set up camp. The Allens spent the rest of the day tramping up and down the swamp, but it wasn't until dawn of the next morning that they heard the telltale call of an ivory bill. Later, as the fog began to lift, they finally spotted the bird perched atop a dead pine. An instant later, it was joined by its mate. The Allens spent another day with the ivory bills and took several photographs, but it soon became clear the birds were still courting and hadn't yet laid eggs. If the Allens bothered them too much at this early stage, they might discourage them from nesting. As far as Arthur Allen knew, this might be the last breeding pair of ivory bills in the world. So he decided to leave them alone for a couple weeks to be safe. Allen immediately wrote an exuberant dispatch for Bird Lore, the precursor to Audubon magazine. "I have just enjoyed one of the greatest experiences of my life, for I have found that which they said could not be found, the ivory-billed woodpecker." His joy was short-lived. When he returned to the nest site a couple weeks later, the birds were gone, and the mud at the edge of the swamp was full of fresh boot prints. He later found out that a couple of local taxidermists had heard about the ivory bill's rediscovery and shot the birds. The loss of those ivory bills was devastating to Allen. He sent letters to many people, including Audubon President T. Gilbert Pearson. "I wish we could do something to get complete protection for the ivory bills from ambitious taxidermists and collectors," he wrote. Allen had just taken over as chairman of the AOU's Committee on Bird Protection, which had been completely ineffectual before then. As Willard Van Name of the American Museum of Natural History wrote in a letter to Allen, "The Committee on Bird Protection, which preceded yours, was appointed with the express purpose of doing nothing, and performed that function with admirable efficiency for many years, thereby materially assisting many of our finest birds on their way to extinction." "While I am chairman," Allen replied, "I shall make an effort each year to have such matters brought before the convention." At the next annual meeting of the AOU, Allen got three conservation resolutions passed, including one demanding the complete protection of any species on the verge of extinction. But his greatest achievement was to establish a different way of doing bird research, focused on observing living birds, especially those in trouble. A few years later, Allen located another nesting ivory bill pair in an old-growth forest in Louisiana and finally had a chance to do an in-depth study. He sat watching the nest for days, taking notes on everything the birds did. He also took spectacular still photographs and motion pictures, while his associate, Peter Paul Kellogg, made the first sound recording of the species. In 2021, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service moved to declare the bird extinct, but some ornithologists believe the bird is still out there, so the government held off for now. Allen's greatest accomplishment was the fundamental paradigm shift he helped effect in the field of ornithology. Through a lengthy career, he popularized bird study, eventually teaching more than 10,000 Cornell undergraduates and directing the studies of some of the most renowned ornithologists of the 20th century. He also founded the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, a major force in bird conservation. When pesticides drove the North American peregrine falcon to the near extinction in the 1960s, Tom Cade, a Cornell professor and director of raptor research at the Lab of Ornithology, set up a massive captive breeding project, producing several thousand young falcons and releasing them into the wild. The peregrine falcon bounced back and was removed from the endangered species list in 1999. Bird conservation has thrived since then, with successes such as the California condor and the whooping crane. And now we have the Search for Lost Birds Project, a worldwide citizen science venture to help people search for 144 bird species that have not been seen in a decade or more. Today's scientists will do their absolute best to save them from extinction. Arthur Allen deserves a great deal of credit for bringing about this profound change in attitude. To follow up, we have How a Worldwide Search Party Took Wing by Kate Wheeling. More than 120 species of birds are considered to be lost, not recorded or captured in the wild for more than 10 years. Now, the Search for Lost Birds, a global partnership of conservancy organizations, is offering everyday people a database and encouraging them to gather and share information about the lost birds they might see in the wild. Even in an era of record-breaking species loss, the wild corners of the earth may still harbor creatures long feared extinct. Collecting data from experts and citizen scientists, the project has found 15 species since its founding in 2021. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.